contrite, mostly, for being first a general, then a wounded soldier. To his delight, only 3 days had passed. There was still time. I've seen most of the sights.
You have?
I'm happy to go back to the Louvre if you want.
No, no. That's perfect. I want to see a shop Louis told me about. I think you deserve a present.
This party on the Rue du Bac is going as badly as possible. Having been approached by Finley Dwyer and informed of his literary crimes, he still cannot manage to locate Alexander. And either the moose is off or his stomach is. It is clearly time to leave. His stomach is far too weak to hear about the wedding. His plane is in 5 hours in any case. Les begins to eye the room for the hostess, hard to pick her out in this sea of black dresses, and finds someone beside him. A Spanish face smiling through a deep tan. The blackmailer.
You are a friend of Alexander. I am Javier,
the man says. He holds in his hand a plate of salmon and couscous. Green golden eyes, straight black hair, center parted, long enough to push behind his ears. Les says nothing. He suddenly feels hot and knows he has flushed bright pink. Perhaps it is the drink.
And you are American,
the man adds. Nonplussed, Les turns an even brighter hue.
How did you know?
The man's eyes dart up and down his body.
You are dressed like an American.
Les looks down at his linen pants, his furred leather jacket. He understands that he has fallen under the spell of a shopkeeper, as has many an American before him. He has spent a small fortune to dress as Parisians might, rather than as they do. He should have worn the blue suit. He says,
I'm Arthur. Arthur Les, a friend of Alexander. He invited me, but he doesn't seem to be coming.
The man leans in, but has to look up. He is quite a bit shorter than Les.
He always invites, Arthur. He never comes.
Actually, I was about to leave. I don't know anybody here.
No, don't leave.
Javier seems to realize he has said this too loudly.
I have a plane to catch tonight.
Arthur, stay one moment. I also know nobody here. You see those two over there?
He nods toward a woman in a backless black dress, her blonde chignon lit by a nearby lamp, and a man all in grays with an oversized Humphrey Bogart head. They are standing side by side examining a drawing. Javier gives a conspiratorial grin. A strand of hair has come loose and hangs over his forehead.
I was talking with them. We all just met, but I could sense very quickly that I was not needed. That is why I came over here.
Javier pats the stray hair back in place.
They are going to sleep together.
Les laughs and says surely they didn't say that.
No, but look at their bodies. Their arms are touching. And he leans in to talk to her. It is not loud here. He is leaning in just to be close to her. They did not want me there.
At that moment, Humphrey Bogart puts his hand on the woman's shoulder and points to the drawing, talking. His lips are so close to her ear that his breath blows her loose wisps of hair. Now it is obvious. They are going to sleep together. He turns back to Javier, who shrugs.
What can you do?
Les asks, and that is why you came over here? Javier's eyes remain on Les.
It is part of why I came over here.
Les allows the warmth of this flattery to wash over him. Javier's expression does not change. For a moment, they are silent. Time expands slightly, taking its deep breath. Les understands it is up to him to make a move. He recalls when, as a boy, a friend would dare him to touch something hot. The silence is broken only by the sound of a glass, also broken, dropped by Finley Dwyer onto the slate floor.
And so you are flying back to America?
Javier asks.
No, to Morocco. Ah, my mother was Moroccan. You are going to Marrakesh? To the Sahara? Then to Fez, no? It is the normal visit.
Did Javier just wink?
I guess I'm the normal visitor.
Yes. It seems unfair you have me pegged while you're a mystery.
Another wink. I'm not. I'm not. I only know your mother was Moroccan.
Sexy, continuous winking.
I am sorry, Javier says, frowning. It's good to be a mystery.
Les tries to say this as sensually as possible.
I am sorry. I have something in my eye.
Javier's right eye is now blinking rapidly, a panicked bird. From its outer edge, a rivulet of tears begins to flow.
Are you okay?
Javier clenches his teeth and blinks and rubs.
This is so embarrassing. The lenses are new for me and irritating. They are French.
Les does not fill in the punchline. He watches Javier and worries. He once read in a novel about a technique for removing a speck from another's eye. You use the tip of your tongue. But it seems so intimate, more intimate than a kiss, that he cannot even bear to mention it. And, being from a novel, it is possibly an invention.
It is out,
Javier exclaims after a final flurry of lashes.
I am free.
Or you've gotten used to the French. Javier's face is blotched with red. Tears shine on his right cheek and his lashes are matted and thick. He smiles bravely. He is a little breathless. He looks to Les like someone who has run a long distance to be here.
And there vanishes the mystery,
Javier says, resting his hand on a table and faking a laugh. Les wants to kiss him. He wants to hold him and protect him. Instead, without thinking at all, he rests his hand on Javier's. It is still wet with tears. Javier looks up at him with those green golden eyes. He is so close that Les can smell the orange scent of his pomade.
They stand there for a moment, perfectly still. A group en biscuit.
His hand on Javier's. His eyes on his. It feels possible that memory will never be finished with this moment. Then they step apart. Arthur Les has flushed as pink as a prom carnation. Javier takes a deep breath, then breaks their gaze.
I wonder,
Les begins in a struggle to say almost anything at all,
if you have any tips about the vat.
The room, which they are blind to, is papered in green-striped fabric and hung with preliminary drawings or cartoons for a greater work of art. Here a hand with a pen, here a woman's upturned face. Above the fireplace mantel, the painting itself. A woman paused in thought while writing a letter. Bookshelves go to the ceiling, and if he looked, Les would find, besides one of H.H.H. Mandarin's Peabody novels, a collection of American stories in which, surprise of surprises, one of his is featured. The hostess has not read it. She kept it because of an affair she had long ago with another featured writer. She has read the two books of poetry, Two Shelves Above, by Robert, but she does not know that there is any connection to one of her guests. Yet here again, the lovers meet. By now, the sun has set, and Les has found a way past the European tax system. Les's endearing backward laugh.
Ah, 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 ah.
Before I came here, Les is now saying, feeling the champagne taking possession of his tongue, I went to the Musée d'Orsay.
It's wonderful. I was very moved by the Gauguin carvings. But then, out of nowhere, there was Van Gogh.
Three self-portraits. I walked up to one. It was protected with glass. I could see my reflection, and I thought, oh my God. Les shakes his head, and his eyes widen as he relives the moment. I look just like Van Gogh. Javier laughs, his hand to his smile.
Before the ear, I think.
I thought, I've gone crazy, Les goes on. But I've already outlived him by over a decade. Javier tilts his head, a cocker spaniard.
Arthur? How old are you?
Deep breath. I'm 49. Javier moves closer to peer at him. He smells of cigarettes and vanilla, like Les's grandmother.
How funny. I am also 49.
No, Les says, truly bewildered. There is not a line on Javier's face. I thought you were mid-30s.
That is a lie, but it is a nice lie. And you do not look close to 50.
Les smiles. My birthday is in 1 week.
Strange to be almost 50, no? I feel like I just understood how to be young.
Yes. It's like the last day in a foreign country. You finally figure out where to get coffee and drinks and a good steak, and then you have to leave, and you won't ever be back.
You put it very well.
I'm a writer. I put things very well. But I'm told I'm spoony.
I am sorry.
Foolish. Tender-hearted. Javier seems delighted.
That is a nice phrase. Tender-hearted. Tender-hearted.
He takes a deep breath as if building courage.
I am, I think, the same.
Javier has a look of sadness about him as he says this. Then he stares directly into his drink. The sky out the window is lowering the last of its gauzy veils, revealing bright, naked Venus. Les looks at the gray strands in Javier's black hair, the prominent, rose-tinted bridge of his nose, the bent head over the white shirt, two buttons open to reveal his date-colored skin, flecked with hairs leading into shadow. More than a few of the hairs are white. He imagines Javier naked. The gold-green eyes as the man peers up at him from a white bed. He imagines touching that warm skin. This evening is unexpected. This man is unexpected. Les thinks of when he bought a wallet in a thrift shop and in it found $100.
I want a cigarette,
Javier says with a child's abashed face. I'll join you. Les says, and together they step out of the open window onto a narrow stone balcony where other smoking Europeans glance back at the American as on a member of the secret police. At the corner of the house, the balcony turns, offering a view of slanted metal rooftops and chimneys. They are alone here, and Javier takes out a pack and pulls on its contents so that two white tusks emerge. Les shakes his head.
Actually, I don't smoke.
They laugh. Javier says,
I think I am a little drunk, Arthur. I think I am, too.
Les's smile has expanded to its full size, here alone with Javier. Is it the champagne that makes him emit an audible sigh? They are side by side at the railing. The chimneys all look like flower pots. Looking out at the view, Javier says,
Here is something strange about growing old.
What's that?
I meet new friends, and they are bald or they are gray. And I don't know what color their hair used to be. I never thought about it.
Now Javier turns to look at Les. He is probably the type to turn and look at you while he is driving.
A friend. I have known him for 5 years. Maybe he is in his late 50s. And I asked him once. I was so surprised to find he was a redhead.
Les nods in agreement.
I was on the street the other day in New York City, and an old man came up to me and hugged me. I had no idea who he was. He was my old lover.
Dios mío,
Javier says, swallowing a gulp of champagne. Les feels his arm against Javier's, and even through the layers of fabric, his skin comes alive. He so desperately wants to touch this man. Javier says,
Me. I was at dinner, and an old man was beside me, so boring, talking about real estate. I thought, please God, do not let me be this man when I am old. Later, I find out he was a year younger than I.
Les puts down his glass and bravely puts his hand again on Javier's. Javier turns to face him.
And also, Les says meaningfully, being the only single man your age.
Javier says nothing but just gives a sad smile. Les blinks, removes his hand, and takes one half step away from the railing. Now, in the new space between him and the Spaniard, one can make out the erector-set miracle of the Eiffel Tower. Les asks, "You're not single, are you?" Smoke leaks from Javier's mouth as he shakes his head gently side to side.
"We have been together 18 years. He is in Madrid. I am here. Married."
Javier waits a long time before he answers.
"Yes. Married.
So you see? I was right.
That you are the only single man?"
Les closes his eyes.
"That I am foolish."
There is piano music inside. The sun has been put to work, and whatever hangover he has does not show in the bright garlands of notes that come out the window onto the balcony. The other smokers all turn and walk over to see and listen. The sky is now nothing but night.
"No, no, you are not foolish."
Javier puts his hand on the sleeve of Les's ridiculous jacket.
"I wish I were single."
Les smiles bitterly at the subjunctive, but does not move his arm.
"I'm sure you don't. Otherwise you would be." "It is not so simple, Arthur."
Les pauses.
"But it is too bad."
Javier moves his hand up to Les's elbow.
"It is very too bad. When do you leave?"
He checks his watch.
"I leave for the airport in an hour."
"Oh." A sudden look of pain in those gold-green eyes.
"I am not to meet you again, am I?"
He must have been slim in his youth, with long black hair colored blue in certain light as in old comic books. He must have swum in the sea in an orange Speedo and fallen in love with the man smiling on shore. He must have gone from bad affair to bad affair until he met a dependable man at an art museum, just 5 years older, already going bald, with a bit of a belly but an easy demeanor that promised escape from heartbreak, off in Madrid, that palace of a city shimmering in the heat. Surely it was a decade or more before they married. How many late dinners of ham and pickled anchovies? How many arguments over the sock drawer, blacks mixing with navy blues, until they decided at last to have separate drawers? Separate duvets, as in Germany. Separate brands of coffee and tea. Separate vacations, his husband to Greece, completely bald but the belly in check, and he to Mexico. Alone on a beach again in an orange Speedo, no longer slim. Trash gathering along the shoreline from cruise ships and a view of Cuba's dancing lights. He must have been lonely a long time to stand before Arthur Les and ask such a thing. On a rooftop in Paris, in his black suit and white shirt. Any narrator would be jealous of this possible love on this possible night. Les stands there in the furred leather jacket against the nighttime city. With his sad expression, three quarters turned to Javier, his gray shirt, his striped scarf, his blue eyes and copper-colored beard, he looks unlike himself. He looks like Van Gogh. A flight of starlings goes off behind him, headed to church.
"We're too old to think we'll meet again," Les says.
Javier rests his hand on Les's waist and steps toward him. Cigarettes and vanilla.
"Passengers to Marrakesh?"
Arthur Les sits in the Lesian manner, legs crossed at the knee, free foot fidgeting, and, as usual, his long legs find themselves in the way of one passenger after another with their rolling suitcases so enormous, Les cannot imagine what they are bringing to Morocco. The traffic is so constant that he has to uncross his legs and sit back. He still wears his new Parisian clothes, the linen of his trousers slackened from a day of use, the coat suffocatingly hot. He is weary and drunk from the party, and his face is aglow with alcohol and doubt and arousal. He has, however, succeeded in mailing his tax-free form, and for this he wears, having passed by his nemesis, the tax lady, the smug smile of a criminal who has pulled off one last heist. Javier promised to mail it in the morning. It is tucked inside that slim black jacket against that firm Iberian chest. so it was not all for nothing. Was it? He closes his eyes. In his distant youth, he often comforted his anxious mind with images of book covers, of author photographs, of newspaper clippings. These things he can now call easily to mind. They hold no comfort. Instead, his brain's staff photographer produces a contact sheet of identical images. Javier pulling him toward the stone wall and kissing him.
This flight is overbooked, and we are looking for volunteers.
Overbooked again. But Arthur Less does not hear her, or else he cannot consider a second stay of execution, a second day of possibilities before he turns 50. Perhaps it is all too much. Or else, just enough. The piano piece ends, and the guests break into applause. From across the roofs comes either the echo of the applause or that of another party. A triangle of amber light catches one of Javier's eyes and makes it gleam like glass. And all that goes through Les's mind is the single thought, ask me. With the married man smiling and touching Les's red beard, ask me. Kissing him for perhaps half an hour longer, and here we have another man fallen under the spell of Les's kiss, pushing him against the wall, unzipping his jacket, touching him passionately, and whispering beautiful things, but not the words that would change everything, for it is still possible to change everything, until Les tells him at last that it is time to go. Javier nods, walking him back into the green-striped room and standing beside him as he says his goodbyes to the hostess and to the other murder suspects in his terrible French. Ask me. Taking him to the front door and walking him downstairs as far as the street, all done in blue watercolors, blurred by the mist of rain, the carved stone porticos and wet satin streets. Ask me. And the poor Spaniard offers his own umbrella, refused, before smiling sadly.
I am sorry to see you go.
And waving goodbye.
Ask me, and I will stay.
There is a call on Les's phone, but he is preoccupied. Already inside the plane, nodding to the beaky blonde steward who greets him, as they always do, in the language not of the passenger, steward, or airport, but of the plane itself. Buena sera, for it is Italian. Bumping his awkward way down the aisle, assisting a tiny woman with her enormous overhead luggage, and finding his favorite seat. The rightmost, rearmost corner. No children to kick you from behind. Prison pillow, prison blanket. He removes his tight French shoes and slides them under the seat. Out the window, nighttime Charles de Gaulle. Will-o'-the-wisps, and men waving glowing wands. He closes the shade, then closes his eyes. He hears his neighbor sitting down roughly and speaking Italian, and he nearly understands it. Brief memory of swimming in a golf resort. Brief false memory of Dr. S. Brief real memory of rooftops and vanilla.
Welcome you on our flight from Paris to Marrakesh.
The chimneys all looked like flower pots. There is a second call, this time from an unknown number, but we will never know what it contains, for no message is left, and the intended receiver is already deep in takeoff slumber, high above the continent of Europe, only 7 days from 50, headed now at last to Morocco. Les Moroccan. What does a camel love? I would guess nothing in the world. Not the sand that scours her, or the sun that bakes her, or the water she drinks like a teetotaler. Not sitting down, blinking her lashes like a starlet. Not standing up, moaning in indignant fury as she manages her adolescent limbs. Not her fellow camels, to whom she shows the disdain of an heiress forced to fly coach. Not the humans who have enslaved her. Not the oceanic monotony of the dunes. Not the flavorless grass she chews, then chews again, then again in a sullen struggle of digestion. Not the hellish day. Not the heavenly night. Not the sunset, not sunrise, not the sun or the moon or the stars, and surely not the heavy American. A few pounds overweight, but not bad for his age, taller than most and top-heavy, tipping from side to side as she carries this human, this Arthur Less, pointlessly across the Sahara. Before her, Mohammed, a man in a long white jellaba and with a blue shesh wound around his head, leading her by a rope. Behind her, the 8 other camels in her caravan, because 9 people signed up to travel to this encampment, though only 4 of the camels have passengers. They have lost 5 people since Marrakesh. They are soon to lose another. Atop her, Arthur Less in his own blue shesh, admiring the dunes, the little wind devils dancing on each crest, the sunset coloration of turquoise and gold, thinking at least he will not be alone for his birthday. Days earlier, awakening from the Paris flight to find himself on the African continent, a bleary-eyed Arthur Less. Body still a tingle with champagne and Javier's caresses and a rather awkward window seat, he staggers across the tarmac beneath a dyed indigo night sky and into an immigration line that is beyond reason. The French, so stately at home, seem instantly to have lost their minds on the soil of their former colony. It is like the redoubled madness of seeing a lover you have wronged. They ignore the line, removing the ropes from the carefully ordered stanchions, and become a mob charging into Marrakesh. The Moroccan officers, in the green and red of cocktail olives, stay calm. Passports are examined, then stamped. Less imagines this happens all day, every day. He finds himself shouting, "Madame! Madame!" at a French woman, elbowing her way through the crowd. She pouts with a shrug, "C'est la vie," and keeps going. Is there an invasion he has not heard of? Is this the last plane out of France? If so, where is Ingrid Bergman? So there is still plenty of time, as he shuffles with the crowd, in which, though European, he still towers, to panic. He could have remained in Paris, or at least have accepted yet another delay and 600 euros. He could have tossed this whole foolish adventure aside for one even more foolish. Arthur Less was supposed to go to Morocco, but he met a Spaniard in Paris, and no one has heard from him since. A rumor for Freddy to hear. But if he is anything, Arthur Less is a man who follows his plan. And so he is here. At least he will not be alone.
"Arthur, you've grown a beard."
His old friend Louis, outside customs, joyous as ever. Tarnished silver hair worn long over the ears and bristling white on his chin. Plump-faced and well-clad in gray linen and cotton. Capillaries spreading in a fertile delta across his nose. Signs that Louis Delacroix is, at nearly 60, a stride ahead of Arthur Less. Less smiles warily and touches his beard.
I thought I needed a change."
Louis holds him at a distance to study him.
"It's sexy. Let's get you into some air conditioning. There's a heat wave on, and even these Marrakesh nights have been hell. Sorry your flight was delayed. What a nightmare to wait a whole day. Did you manage to fall in love with 14 hours in Paris?"
Les is startled and says he called up Alexander. He talks about the party and Alex not showing up. He doesn't mention Javier. Louis turns to him and asks,
"Do you want to talk about Freddy? Or do you not want to talk about Freddy?"
"Not talk." His friend nods. Louis, whom he met for the first time on that long road trip after college, who offered his cheap apartment on Valencia Street above the communist bookstore, who introduced him to acid and electronic music. Handsome Louis Delacroix, who seemed so adult, so assured. He was 30. A generation apart back then. Now they are essentially contemporaries. And yet Louis has always seemed so much steadier. With the same boyfriend for 20 years, he is the very model of love's success. And glamorous. This trip, for instance, is exactly the kind of luxury that afforded Louis's fascinating stories. It is a birthday trip, not for Arthur Less. For some woman named Zora, who is also turning 50, and whom Less has never met.
I'd say let's get some sleep, Lewis says as they find a taxi. But nobody at the hotel is asleep. They've been drinking since noon. And who knows what else. I blame Zora. Well, you'll meet Zora.
The actress is the first to go. Perhaps it is the pale Moroccan wine poured glass after glass at dinner on the roof of the rented house, the Riad, with a view of that upraised pupil's hand, the minaret of the Koutoubia Mosque. Or perhaps the gin and tonics she requests after dinner when she sheds her clothes, the two Riad workers, both named Mustafa, say nothing, and slips into the courtyard pool, where turtles stare at her pale flesh, wishing they were still dinosaurs, the water rippling from her backstroke as the others continue to introduce themselves. Les is in here somewhere, struggling with a wine bottle between his thighs. Or perhaps the tequila she discovers later, once the gin runs out, when someone has found a guitar and someone else a shrill local flute, and she begins an improvisational dance with a lantern on her head before someone leads her out of the pool. Or perhaps the whiskey, later passed around. Or the hashish. Or the cigarettes. Or the three loud claps of the Riad's neighbor, a princess. The sign they are up too late for Marrakesh. But how will we ever know? All we know is that in the morning, she is unable to get out of bed. Naked, she calls for a drink, and when someone brings her water, she knocks the glass away and says, "I mean vodka." And because she is unwilling to move, and because their ride to the Sahara leaves at noon, and because her last two movies were in dubious taste, and because nobody but the birthday girl even knows her, it is in the care of the two Mustafas that they leave her.
"Will she be okay?" Les asks Lewis. "I'm so surprised she couldn't hold her liquor," Lewis says, turning to him with his enormous sunglasses. They make him look like a nocturnal primate. They are seated together in a small bus. A freak heat wave has made the world outside shimmer like a wok. The rest of the passengers lean wearily against the windows.
"I thought actors were made from steel."
"Please to all," says their guide into his microphone. This is Mohammed, their Moroccan guide, in a red polo shirt and jeans. "Here we are to pass through the Atlas Mountains. They are, we say, like snake. Tonight we arrive at," name garbled by microphone, "where we spend the night. Tomorrow is the Valley of Palms."
"I thought tomorrow was the desert," comes a British accent Les recognizes from the night before as that of the technology genius who retired at 40 and now runs a nightclub in Shanghai.
"Oh yes, I promised the desert."
Mohammed is short with long curly hair, probably in his 40s. His smile is quick, but his English is slow.
"I am sorry for the unpleasant surprise of the heat."
From the back, a female voice, Korean, the violinist.
"Can they turn up the air?"
Some words in Arabic, and the vents begin to blast warm air into the bus.
"My friend said it was at top."
Mohammed smiles.
"But we now know it was not at top."
The air does nothing to cool them. Beside them, on the road out of Marrakesh, are groups of school children making their way home for lunch. They hold shirts or books over their faces to shield themselves from the merciless sun. Miles of adobe walls and, now and then, the oasis of a coffee shop where men stare at the bus as they pass. Here is a pizza joint, and here an uncompleted gas station. Africa. Someone has tied a donkey to a telephone pole in the middle of nowhere and left it there. The driver turns on music, the somehow enchanting drone of Nawa. Lewis seems to have fallen asleep. In those glasses, Les cannot tell. Tahiti.
"I've always wanted to go to Tahiti," Freddie told him once at an afternoon rooftop gathering of his young friends.
A few other older men peppered the crowd, eyeing each other like fellow predators.
Les did not know how to signal that in this crowd of gazelles, he was a vegetarian.
My last boyfriend, he wanted to tell them, is now in his 60s.
Did any of them, like him, prefer middle-aged men? He never found out. They avoided him as if magnetically repulsed. Eventually at these parties, Freddy would float over with a weary expression, and they would spend the last hours, just the two of them, chatting. And this time, perhaps it was the tequila and sunset, Freddy had brought up Tahiti.
That sounds nice, Les said. But to me it seems so resorty. Like you'd never meet the locals. I want to go to India.
Freddy gave a shrug. Well, you'd definitely get to meet the locals in India. I hear there's nothing but locals. But do you remember when we went to Paris? The Musée d'Orsay? Oh, right, you were sick. Well, there was a room of carvings by Gauguin, and one said, be mysterious. And the other one said, be in love, you will be happy. In French, of course. Those really moved me, more than the paintings. He made the same carving for his house in Tahiti. I know, I'm strange. I should want to go because of the beaches. But I want to see his house.
Les was about to say something, but just then the sun, hidden behind Buena Vista, was glorifying a fog bank, and Freddy went straight to the railing to see it.
They never talked about Tahiti again, so Les never gave it another thought. But clearly, Freddy did.
Because that is where he must be now, on his honeymoon with Tom. Be in love, you will be happy. Tahiti.
It doesn't take long to lose the next ones. The bus makes it to 8 Ben Haddou with one lunch stop at a hallucinogenically tiled roadhouse where they are led out of the bus. Ahead of him is a couple, both war reporters. The night before, they were regaling Les with stories of Beirut in the 80s, such as one about the bar whose cockatoo could imitate incoming bombs. A chic French woman with bobbed white hair and bright cotton slacks, a tall mustachioed German in a photojournalist jacket, they have come from Afghanistan to laugh, chain smoke, and learn a new dialect of Arabic. The world seems to be theirs. Nothing can take them down. Zora, the birthday girl, comes over and walks beside him.
Arthur, I am so glad you came.
Not tall, but definitely alluring, in a long-sleeved yellow dress that shows off her legs, she possesses a unique beauty, with the long nose and shining, oversized eyes of a Byzantine portrait of Mary. Every one of her movements, touching the back of a seat, brushing her hair from her face, smiling at one of her friends, is purposeful. And her gaze is direct and discerning. Her accent would be impossible to place. English? Mauritian? Basque? Hungarian? Except Les already knows, from Lewis, that she was born right here in Morocco, but left as a child for England. This is her first trip home in a decade. He has watched her with her friends. She is always laughing, always smiling, but he sees, when she walks away, the shadow of some deep sadness. Glamorous, intelligent, resilient, bracingly direct, and prone to obscenities, Zora seems like the kind of woman who would run an international spy ring. For all Les knows, this is exactly what she does. Most of all, she does not look anywhere near 50 or even 40. You would never know she drinks like a sailor as well as swears like one, smokes one menthol after another. She certainly looks younger than lined and weary, old and broke and loveless Arthur Les. Zora fixes her dazzling eyes on him.
You know, I'm a big fan of your books.
Oh, he says. They are walking along beside a low wall of ancient bricks, and below, a series of whitewashed houses rises from the river.
I really loved Calypso. Really, really loved it. You motherfucker, you made me cry at the end.
I guess I'm glad to hear that.
It was so sad, Arthur. So fucking sad. What's your next one?
She flips her hair over her shoulder, and it moves in a long, fluid line. He finds himself clenching his teeth. Below, two boys on horseback are moving slowly up the river shallows. Zora frowns.
I'm freaking you out. I shouldn't have asked. None of my fucking business.
No, no, Arthur says. It's okay. I wrote a new novel, and my publisher hates it.
What do you mean?
Well, they turned it down. Declined to publish it. I remember when I sold my first book, the head of the publishing house sat me down in his office, and he gave me this long speech about how he knew they didn't pay very much, but they were a family, and I was now part of that family. They were investing in me not for this book, but for my entire career. That was only 15 years ago, and bam, I'm out. Some family.
Sounds like my family. What was your new novel about?
Catching his expression, she quickly adds,
Arthur, I hope you know you can tell me to bugger off.
He has a rule which is never to describe his books until after they are published. People are so careless with their responses, and even a skeptical expression can feel akin to someone saying about your new lover, don't tell me you're dating him. But for some reason, he trusts her. It was, he starts, stumbling on a rock in the path, then starts again. It was about a middle-aged gay man walking around San Francisco, and you know, his sorrows.
Her face has begun to fold inward in a dubious expression, and he finds himself trailing off.
From the front of the group, the journalists are shouting in Arabic.
Zora asks, Is it a white, middle-aged man?
Yes.
A white, middle-aged American man walking around with his white, middle-aged American sorrows?
Jesus, I guess so.
Arthur, sorry to tell you this. It's a little hard to feel sorry for a guy like that.
Even gay?
Even gay.
Bugger off. He did not know he was going to say this. She stops walking, points at his chest and grins.
Good for you, she says.
And then he notices before them a crenellated castle on a hill. It seems to be made of sun-baked mud. It seems impossible. Why did he not expect this? Why did he not expect Jericho?
This, Muhammad announces, is the ancient walled city of the tribe of Hadu. Eight means a Berber tribe. Ben means from, and Hadu is the family. And so, Eight Ben Hadu. There are eight families still living within the walls of the city.
Why did he not expect Nineveh, Sidon, Tyre?
I'm sorry, says the tech whiz nightclub owner. You say there are eight families, or eight families?
Eight families. The number eight? Once it was a village, but now only a few families remain. Eight.
Babylon.
Once again, the number eight, or the name eight?
Yes. Eight families. Eight Ben Hadu. It is at this point that the female war reporter leans over the ancient wall and commences vomiting. The miracle before them is forgotten. Her husband runs to her side and holds back her beautiful hair. The setting sun puts the adobe scene in blue shadows, and somehow Les is taken back to the color scheme of his childhood home when his mother went mad for the Southwest. From across the river, a cry comes up like an air raid siren. The evening call to prayer. The castle, or Kasar, Eight Ben Hadu, rises unfeeling before them.
The husband tries, at first, a furious exchange in German with the guide, then one in Arabic with the driver, followed by French, ending in an incomprehensible tirade meant only for the gods. His command of English curses goes untested. His wife clutches her head and tries to stand, but collapses into the driver's arms, and they are all taken quickly back to the bus.
Migraine, Lewis whispers to him. Booze. The altitude. I bet she's down for the count.
Les takes one last look at the ancient castle of mud and straw, remade every year or so as the rains erode the walls plastered and replastered so that nothing remains of the old Kasar except its former pattern. Something like a living creature of which not a cell is left of the original. Something like an Arthur Less. And what is the plan? Will they just keep rebuilding forever? Or one day will someone say, "Hey, what the hell? Let it fall. Bugger off." And that will be the end of Eighth Ben-Hadou. Less feels on the verge of an understanding about life and death and the passage of time, an ancient and perfectly obvious understanding, when a British voice intervenes.
"Okay, sorry to be a bother. Just want to make sure. Once again, it's eight?"
"Prayer is better than sleep," comes the morning cry from the mosque, "but travel is better than prayer, for as the muezzin chants, they are all already packed into the bus and waiting for the guide to return with the war reporters."
Their hotel, a dark stone labyrinth at night, reveals itself at sunrise to be a palace in a valley of lush palms. By the front door, two little boys giggle over a chick they hold in their hands. Colored a bright orange, either artificially or supernaturally, the chick chirps at them ceaselessly, furiously, indignantly, but they only laugh and show the creature to luggage-burdened Arthur Less. On the bus, he seats himself beside the Korean violinist and her male model boyfriend. The young man looks over at Less with a blank blue stare. What does a male model love? Lewis and Zora sit together laughing. The guide returns. The war reporters are still recovering, he reports, and will join them on a later camel. So the bus guffaws to life. Good to know there is always a later camel. The rest is a Dramamine nightmare. A drunkard's route up the mountain, at every switchback, the miraculous gleam of geodes set out for sail, a young boy jumping at the bus's approach, rushing quickly to the roadside, holding out a violet-dyed geode, only to be covered in a cloud of dust as they depart. Here and there, a kasbah with fire-clay walls and a great green wooden door, the donkey door, Muhammad explains, with a small door set inside, the people door, but never a sign of either donkeys or people, just the arid acacia mountainside. The passengers are sleeping or staring out the window and chatting quietly. The violinist and the male model are whispering intensely, and so Les makes his way back where he finds Zora staring out a window. She motions, and he sits beside her.
"You know what I've decided," she says sternly, as if calling a meeting to order, "about turning 50? Two things. The first is, fuck love."
"I don't know what that means."
"It means, give it up. Fuck it. I gave up smoking, and I can give up love."
He eyes the pack of menthols in her purse.
"What? I've given it up several times. Romance isn't safe at our age."
"So, Lewis told you I'm also turning 50?
"Yes. Happy birthday, darling. We're going down the shitter together."
She's nothing short of delighted to have learned that her birthday is the day before his.
"Okay. No romance at our age. Actually, that's a huge relief. I might get more writing done. What's the second?"
"It's related to the first one."
"Okay."
"Get fat."
"Huh.
Fuck love and just get fat. Like Lewis."
Lewis turns his head.
"Who, me?"
"You,"
Zora says.
"Look how fucking fat you've gotten."
"Zora," Les says.
But Lewis just chuckles. With two hands, he pats the mound of his belly.
"You know, I think it's a hoot. I look in the mirror every morning and laugh and laugh and laugh. Me, skinny little Lewis Delacroix."
"So that's the plan, Arthur. Are you in?" Zora asks.
"But I don't want to get fat," Les says. "I know that sounds stupid and vain, but I don't."
Lewis leans in closer. "Arthur, you're going to have to figure something out. You see all these men over 50, these skinny men with mustaches. Imagine all the dieting and exercise and effort of fitting into your suits from when you were 30. And then what? You're still a dried-up old man,
Screw that. Clark always says you can be thin or you can be happy, and Arthur, I have already tried thin.
His husband, Clark.
Yes, they are Lewis and Clark. They still find it hilarious. Hilarious.
Zora leans forward and puts a hand on his arm.
Come on, Arthur. Do it. Get fat with us. The best is yet to come.
There is noise at the front of the bus. The violinist is talking in hushed tones with Muhammad. From one of the window seats, they can now hear the male model's moans.
Oh, no. Not another, Zora says.
You know, Lewis says, I thought he would have gone sooner. So there are only 4 laden camels moving across the Sahara. The male model, sick beyond all measure, has been left with the bus in Mhamid, the last town before the desert, and the violinist has stayed with him.
He will join us on a later camel, Muhammad assures them as they board their camels and are tipped like teapots as the creatures struggle to rise. 4 with humans and 5 without, all in a line, making shadows in the sand, and looking at the damned creatures with their hand-puppet heads and their hay-bale bodies, their scrawny little legs, Les thinks, look at them. Who would ever believe in a god? It is 3 days until his birthday. Zora's is in 2.
This isn't a birthday, Les yells to Lewis as they bob toward the sunset. It's an Agatha Christie novel. Let's bet on who goes next. I'm betting me, right now, on this camel.
I'm betting on Josh,
the British tech whiz.
Lewis asks, would you like to talk about Freddy now?
Not really. I heard the wedding was very pretty.
I heard that the night before, Freddy...
Zora's voice comes loudly from her camel.
Shut the fuck up! Enjoy the fucking sunset on your fucking camels! Jesus!
It is, after all, almost a miracle they are here. Not because they've survived the booze, the hashish, the migraines. Not that at all. It's that they've survived everything in life. Humiliations and disappointments and heartaches and missed opportunities. Bad dads and bad jobs and bad sex and bad drugs. All the trips and mistakes and faceplants of life to have made it to 50 and to have made it here. To this frosted cake landscape, these mountains of gold, the little table they can now see sitting on the dune, set with olives and pita and glasses and wine chilling on ice, with the sun waiting more patiently than any camel for their arrival. So, yes. As with almost every sunset, but with this one in particular, shut the fuck up. The silence lasts as long as it takes a camel to summit a dune. Lewis notes aloud that today is his 20th anniversary, but of course his phone won't work out here, so he'll have to call Clark when they get to Fez. Mohammed turns back and says,
oh, but there is Wi-Fi in the desert.
There is?
Lewis asks.
Oh, of course. Everywhere, Muhammad says, nodding.
Oh, good.
Muhammad holds up one finger.
The problem is the password.
Up and down the line, the Bedouin chuckle.
That's the second time I've fallen for that one, Lewis says, then looks back at Les and points.
There on the dune beside the table, one of the camel boys has his arm around the other, and they sit there like that as they watch the sun. The dunes are turning the same shades of adobe and aqua as the buildings of Marrakesh. 2 boys, arms around each other. To Les, it seems so foreign. It makes him sad. In his world, he never sees straight men doing this. Just as a gay couple cannot walk hand in hand down the streets of Marrakesh, he thinks, 2 men, best friends, cannot walk hand in hand down the streets of Chicago. They cannot sit on a dune like these teenagers and watch a sunset in each other's embrace. This Tom Sawyer love for Huck Finn. The encampment is a dream. begin in the middle. A fire pit, laden with gnarled acacia branches, surrounded by pillows, from which 8 carpeted paths lead to 8 plain canvas tents, each of which, outwardly no more than a smallish revival tent, opens onto a wonderland. A brass bed, whose coverlet is sewn with tiny mirrors, nightstands and bedside lamps in beaten metal, a wash basin and coy little